Chinese brands outpacing multinational giants. Has functionality overtaken brand prestige in China? Do MNCs truly understand the difference between a customer and a user, or is this blind spot costing them the market? Is tradition holding global brands back, or is it sheer arrogance that's eroding their competitive edge? And here's an even bigger question. Is the global auto industry on the verge of collapse? Welcome to China Biz, the podcast that cuts through the noise to uncover real opportunities and challenges in China's business landscape. This episode features Shanghai-based automotive industry legend Bill Russo, founder and CEO of Automobility, a strategy and investment advisory firm helping clients to build and profit from the future of mobility. I am your host, Jacob Johansson, a 25-year China veteran and strategy consultant. But let's be clear, China Biz is an independent non-profit project and does not represent my employer. Let's dive in. Bill Russo, welcome to China Biz, and first and foremost, thank you for joining the show.
It was my great pleasure to be here.
There's been a narrative among multinational companies the last 3, 4, 5 years, maybe longer, about the fact that the competition here is just much, much tougher than it used to be. And when I say competition, it's not competition among the multinationals. It's the domestic competition. That narrative started a little bit from the MNCs, like it's not our fault, unfair competition, or the price is unnaturally low, or the Chinese companies are receiving support, which is not granted the multinationals. There's been many reasons why it was tough for MNCs to compete here. But I see that narrative change a little bit. Some people start to raise their hand and say, hey, maybe the foreign products are actually not good enough, or in another way, maybe the Chinese products are actually better.
Right.
Are Chinese products better than import products?
It really is a dramatic change. In the industry that I work closely with, the automotive, the competitiveness of Chinese companies, as measured perhaps in ways that we as global people from the industry around the world think about the product, is changed. I mean, they understand that it's not the same world that the industry grew up in, right? That we, as multinational companies, serving, I'd say, more mature, more traditional customers with products that were incrementally improved over time, we kind of grew accustomed to that trajectory, that we had sort of a very controlled. We trained our consumers to expect products to be of a certain size, shape, product configuration.
And new iPhone once a year.
Yeah, and price, right? We kind of had our way with the market for so long that, okay, as long as it's not too much more than the previous, that we could practice what I would call a cost-plus way of thinking. Yes, of course, consumers want affordability. If you make it more affordable, you'll have more consumers. That's this basic economics. Most industries around the world tend to be very, I'd say, driving by looking in the rearview mirror, right? Where I'm not really anticipating the future to be much different from the past, and I can sort of approximate where I'm going based on an extrapolation of the past. The trajectory that we've been on is good enough. And because my financial systems require a maximization of return on investment, I make conservative choices, right? I leverage as much of what I've done already in making whatever the next thing is. That leads to what I call a legacy bias or a carryover bias, where we carry over the things that we've already built and we only layer a small maybe value proposition on top of that.
Yeah.
We don't change in a fundamental way the way we think about the consumers or the way that we think about the products that we serve them. China is a disruptor in so many ways because there is no benefit to protecting legacy. There is no legacy,
there is no legacy here, right?
Therefore, you have more degrees of freedom of how you think about the future. You're not bound by a constraint of a system that grinds you to incrementality.
Yeah.
And you look for the things that can separate you. If you're a Chinese branded company, not a joint venture that was sort of a child of a Sino-foreign collaboration, which is a lot of what was the beginning chapter of the automotive industry. If the 40 years since Volkswagen opened up its joint venture with SAIC and American Motors opened up its joint venture with Beijing Jeep, in that 40-year period, the first 30 or so of that, 35 even, were where the foreign brands could have their way in China. Not so in the 2020 and beyond, in the post-COVID world, really 2017 and beyond. In the past decade, we witnessed a dramatic change in the strength of the Chinese automotive industry and the strength of Chinese brands in general, because they recognize that they have the capabilities now that they need to create discontinuous change.
Yeah. You're almost saying that for the MNCs, that the heritage and all the best practices become a limitation to being relevant or at least fitting the needs of the Chinese consumers of today.
Right. It becomes your albatross. It becomes the thing that you have to, it's the weight that you carry. It can be, to a degree, your legacy and your brand identity. You can't throw it away.
Yeah.
But you have to constantly reform what it is that you represent in the eyes of a very changing set of consumer expectations. China's 21st century is almost its entire economic history, right? The everything that preceded the 21st century since the WTO accession was 2001, that's sort of a marker of when this all began to really pivot away. We didn't see it for the first decade of the century because it was, you know, foreign brands got to bring whatever it brought, and Chinese brands were learning. But they were never learning to be your apprentice, to be your replacement, to be your apprentice working in your shop, but to replace your shop with the Chinese shop.
Yeah.
Now, that wasn't what the government forced upon the foreign investors. It's what the market ultimately decided it preferred. The Chinese brands that are rising, in particular in the automotive industry, the one that I'm closest with, those brands are delivering a value proposition better suited to the Chinese lifestyle than the foreign brands understood or cared to understand. It's not just that they weren't paying attention. It's that even if they were paying attention, they thought they had a better idea.
Yeah.
That's an arrogance.
Yeah.
That's a lack of willingness to accept a market that changed rapidly from what we knew it to be just a few decades.
As you say the word arrogance, I was thinking the word arrogance.
Yeah.
Because you are a car guy. I have experience for automotive in China as well. And I feel in some of the conversations I have had with people in automotive that I see that arrogance. They don't recognize the success of the Chinese car industry for what it is. It's always because of some other reason.
Right.
And then they go back to repeat what they were already doing.
Right.
If you have that approach to doing business and especially to do innovation, you build unconsciously a wall that prevent you from seeing the future in the market because it you end up just repeating or doing small incremental improvements on the spot. And what you're saying is that the Chinese disruptors, they don't work that way at all.
Every Chinese company that I've ever worked with in my 21 years here has always been ambitious to be as good as or better than those who they learned from.
Mm.
And what they knew all along is they understood the Chinese market better than we could ever possibly understand. You could learn the nuances by being here for a period of time. But understanding the psychology and the preferences and the pain points that consumers in China face, solving the mobility problem the Western way with individual car ownership was never the the perfect fit for China. Far more people ride than drive. Moving around is inconvenient in densely populated urban environments. This is a very, very inconvenient, was a very inconvenient place to be prior to the smartphone. And now with the smartphone, people have access to the universe of services, many of which are hosted by companies with mobility as part of their value delivery system, right? So if you order a package, it gets delivered to you by a delivery person. Mobility is part of the value chain to get that to you. If you order food or if you book a ride, far more people ride than drive in China, understanding that that's a pain point. And that when you are riding, say you are driving, let's just say you own a car, you spend more time moving at low speed than at high speed. So driving on the highway, which is what the value proposition has been and the mythology has been of the automotive industry and its brands, saying that that's the aspiration of every Chinese person when we're serving them a mobility solution, that they want to have this feeling of racing or on highway performance.
That's driver's car.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. You know, Volkswagen's initial success was because it built a long wheelbase Audi sedan mainly for government officials.
Yes. 12 centimeters longer.
Make it stretch the wheelbase, give them a little more leg room in the back. Well, that tells you something. That says the person who's receiving the most value is not sitting in the front seat behind the steering wheel. Right. That was the 20 years ago proposition. The 2020s proposition is that that person sitting in the car probably wants to have a massage chair, a big screen, a reclining seat, a way to get his drink heated or cooled. These are the features you see in the cars that are being made by Chinese companies. The pervasiveness of the mobile internet is one of the factors that weighed heavily on the reconfiguration of the car into a moving living space. Right? It's no longer just, and by the way, when it's a moving living space, you don't want to feel the acceleration, right? You get motion sickness if you feel acceleration, if you're streaming something while you're seated in a car. It's much more of a relaxing, you know, place to do business, have a call, watch a movie. If you're taking a long distance drive, you probably have family members in the car with you. Paying attention to the in-cabin experience is much more prevalent in the product configurations you see coming from Chinese companies.
Can you share with me examples of the Chinese automotive industry where their products are better, at least for the Chinese market? Let's try to exemplify what it is they do better. You talk about the in-cabin experience, declining chairs and stuff.
Yeah.
But could you give us a couple of other examples?
First of all, the industry was built on the back of companies that had the ability to make the car accessible to the middle-class population, understanding the needs of that. You know, what does it mean to be middle-class? It means you have a reasonably stable income. You're not super rich, but you're looking for basic utility from the products that you consume. It's not ostentatious. It's not luxury. It just needs to serve my everyday need. What are the everyday needs of a consumer of any product? And you know, what are the things that we do every day? We need to eat. We move around. We need to go to work, and we like to enjoy ourselves every now and then with entertainment and shopping experiences. All of that involved mobility. It's either us moving to places, things moving to us, meeting the convenience and the targets for making the things that we do every day affordable and convenient. That's what China understood to be the problem that it was solving. And in the automotive context, that means make the car affordable. They didn't invent that. I would say Henry Ford was the first pioneer democratizing mobility, right? By applying mass production techniques to a previously invented in Germany innovation, which was the automobile.
Right.
The internal combustion engine was invented 20 years prior to the Model T being launched. Carl Benz's car, which used the internal combustion engine, that came in the 1880s. It was full two decades later that Henry Ford had the brilliant idea, after many other car companies came about making very premium rich people toys because it was replacing the horse, right? He made the car affordable by building the Model T. You could get anything you want as long as it was black, had to be highly standardized. But affordability was the goal. China got that, right? In the 21st century, if I'm going to make the Chinese brands relevant, I need to have them make affordable, not poor quality, but good quality, affordable vehicles. Understanding that was its objective has been the goal all along for the Chinese automotive industry. However, it was stuck in a 20th century paradigm for the product configuration, which was the combustion engine powered vehicle and its complexity, which was the supply chain of the network of components that need to be assembled into the vehicle. Bringing that to China, which is what happened after the WTO accession. It actually happened 20 years prior with Volkswagen and Beijing Jeep coming
in.
Initial joint ventures. But people didn't really have, there wasn't a big middle-class population in China. But since 2001, the transference of the capacities in the automotive industry toward China became the growth engine for this industry for the past 25 years. Right, for the entire 21st century, the growth of this industry all came from China. Right, if there was an incrementality to the growth of the automotive industry, it was because China added to the market that was about 60 or 70 million, an additional 30 million units of annual production and consumption. But Chinese companies understood, if we're going to be competitive, I need to democratize the products of this industry. And what really created the opportunity to break away was the advent of the electrified vehicle. Understanding that in order to make the EV affordable, you needed to localize the key components of the electric vehicle, the electronics and the batteries in particular. And that's what China got right. That's what made them different, able to deliver EVs that we see today being sold in China for some cases. The equivalent of 5,000 euro, 10,000 euro, far less than anything you'll find. But the thing that really surprised everyone was they didn't just do that. They also created a whole lot of value in terms of the in-cabin experience. They didn't just prioritize the driving characteristics of the car. They changed the whole interior configuration to where the car is now a rolling smartphone. It's a smartphone on wheels. And why is that important in China? Because the smartphone was the thing that made life more convenient for everyone. People consume the internet and internet-related services through a mobile computer. Most people who use the internet never had a personal computer before they had their smartphone. So the way the economy has been hinged in the 21st century is to the consumption of services available through the app, the mobile internet. The car becomes an extension of that lifestyle.
Yeah.
That's what's different about the Chinese car.
It's funny you say this about the mobile device. I've written a book called From Customer to User, and I write about a new, what I call a new mindset. It's not a new segment of users, but it's a new mindset which is in all of us, and I call that mindset for adult baby. It's that type of personality where we want everything right now, and we want it our way.
Right.
And the source of that mental change is a mobile device.
Right.
Because when we adapt it, the mobile device, and it becomes present in our life at all, you know, 24/7, we got used to getting everything our way and tailored to our personal taste. China is born out of that logic. So that adult baby mindset, if you like, is driving what consumers want from business and products in China today. And if you don't accept that this is not just one small group of users who are so picky on things, but it's everybody. This is a common trait among consumers today. If you don't accept that as an MNC, I think long-term you have a problem staying relevant here.
Right. And I think that's that language of user-centricity. We tend to think of it like, isn't that just listening to the voice of the customer? No, it's different. User and customer are different things. A customer is somebody who buys your product. A user is somebody that consumes your solution
yeah.
or your service.
Yes.
You don't sell them something once every blue moon.
Mm.
You're with them all the time.
Yes.
And that's what changed in the mobile device era.
Right.
Is suddenly we had something that was with us all the time that made our life easier and more convenient. Far more so than in the Western world, where people's habits are multi-generational, right? We may have a smartphone, but we still like going to the shopping mall and buying things at the mall. Whereas in China, the mall, unless you're living in a place like Shanghai where you have to fall over a shopping mall every corner, there are places in China where you can't get stuff unless you have the Taobao
right.
or Jingdong. So the consumption of services, and that's not just buying stuff online.
Mm.
That's things like medical services, or which are inaccessible. There's apps that allow you to get access to things that are difficult that can be brought to you. So I think the consumption pattern changed. The view of the internet economy and how it's transformed lifestyles in such a fundamental way, to where now the car, configured by companies that come from that digital DNA.
Mm.
Well, we're talking about companies like Xiaomi making a car now.
Yeah.
Never made a car before.
Mm.
Launched one last year. It hasn't even been a full year that they've been in production. Already have sold over 150,000 units. And they're about to launch their next car next month, which is an even
with
bigger...
With companies gone everywhere where people talk about automotive, right?
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, this is the shock to the global auto... By the way, BYD, which is also a huge democratizer in making the EV affordable, right? They can sell a car, a BYD Seagull, for under 10,000 US. They can also put a hybrid technology in it to make it as flexible to use as a traditional car, also pricing them very attractively in the $10,000 to $15,000 range. BYD is kind of known around the world now because of the ability to compete so well
right.
in this segment. But what the world hasn't seen yet is the likes of Xiaomi and Huawei and now Tencent-backed NIO and Alibaba-backed Xiaopeng, XPeng.
Yes.
These companies have a digital DNA, and their goal is to democratize not the hardware, but the technology.
I believe companies who are user-centric instead of customer-centric
right.
have a much... stronger ability to innovate and right. understand what people really need than a customer-centric company. Because if we look at it, customer needs are basically related to the purchasing transaction and a few other things. The rest of the time, you don't consider yourself a customer. But you have loads of other needs that goes for vehicles, that goes for kitchens, that goes for whatever. But only if a company is organized around the user instead of the customer only. I write in my book that all users are customers, but not all customers are users. So this is not about forgetting the customer. This is about expanding your perspective.
Right.
If you manage to do that as a business, you will discover so much more opportunity for innovation than a customer-centric business. You mentioned Xiaomi. I think they are maybe the archetype of a user-centric company. Long before we even used the term, they were user-centric. They were thinking beyond the person who was involved in the transaction.
I use it, and there's actually a book I read in college that was recommended by one of my unit operations professors, a chemical engineer, and it was called The Flatland. It's actually a book written in the 19th century, I think.
Okay.
And it tells a story of people who are a creature that lived in a two-dimensional universe, Flatland, encountering the Z-axis for the first time.
Mm.
And when the Z-axis came and tried to explain itself to XY, XY couldn't understand. It was another dimension that they'd never seen before. And I think that's what the automotive industry is today,
mm.
or that's what traditional industries are today.
Right.
They live in flatland. They live in a world where the business has been dictated over generations and the business model has been dictated over generations. And they have a way of kind of boxing themselves into a lit part of the room, and they fail to recognize there's another part of the room that hasn't been illuminated yet. And that's the user centricity business idea.
Okay.
The idea that it's not just a product to sell to an infrequent relationship that you have with somebody you hope stays loyal to your brand, because your brand identity is rooted in product characteristics. In a digital world, your stickiness to the user is an everyday, sometimes transactional, sometimes not. Doesn't mean I'm always taking money from you.
Exactly.
It means I'm always making your life, I'm always solving a pain point for you, whether that's your ability to look up information, me knowing a little bit more about you, therefore giving you some suggestions.
Because there's a return, you get something back.
You get something for it. So in the internet world, the smart device world powered by the mobile internet, inherently understands this. They understand that they're there to aggregate data about you, analyze it, and personalize and recommend to you a set of things that they know you are. We are all creatures of habit.
Yeah.
Things that would make your life better today. That's where the companies like Xiaomi, Huawei with its affiliate HiMa, the Harmony Intelligent Mobility Alliance, they're actually very disruptive, because they're a big, both of these companies, huge device makers who inherently understand how to make a sticky ecosystem and embed it with services that are going to make Chinese individuals' lives better. The reason why people are not, when you look at the purchase consideration and purchase intent, the reason why foreign brands have fallen off the consideration list is because they don't have the DNA needed to compete against companies like that. You need products that match or better the experience of owning a convenient, you know, proud to be, you know, affiliated with you product, right? Cars are like jewelry. They travel with us. Clothing, you know, things that project who you are to your friends.
Yeah.
It used to be you would project your image through luxury purchases or aspirational purchases and say, look at me. I got this Porsche or I got this Rolex. Now technology in China in particular, in this 21st century where the internet is sort of your connected lifestyle is sort of the natural way for people to project their status, right? Their community isn't just the people that they come in contact with, it's their social networks. It's being able to broadcast yourself to the world.
Yeah.
That's where China really shines in the ability to do that. So you can give people a bragging right with in-cabin experiences that allow them to be socially connected through the mobile internet. Or you can give them cool technology that they can brag about. You know, I could brag about my Apple Watch Ultra, and I probably wouldn't get as many brownie points among people who want me to have a Rolex Daytona. But it's a bragging right to a certain class of people. It's like, oh, you got the coolest Apple Watch, or you've got a Vision Pro. China is much more into the technology features in the products that they're carrying today or that they travel with today. So what you are saying about yourself is also part of the calculus. What you're bragging about are technology features that you can see. Look how big the screen is in my car. Look at my massage seats. Look how my car, I had somebody who owned a Neo. They didn't brag about the battery swapping, although they had that feature and they could brag about it. They bragged about the fact that I could sit in the rear seat, passenger side, say, open my window, and my window would open and nobody else's window open, that it could actually locate the voice and make something happen in the car. These are things that I think Chinese consumers, if you don't have it in your car, if you didn't even think of that, then you're probably not even on the consideration list today.
We talk about MNCs being challenged through innovation and understanding the users, but what you're saying is also challenging the MNC mindset, or the, if I may say, Western mindset, particularly on how we understand brands and the value of brands. It's my observations that products and product features, technology, is actually in China much more important than the Western perception of branding. Here, having all those fluffy stories about XYZ value or whatever affiliation you have with, this is much less important. This is about Is the product good enough? Can it do X, Y, Z, what you just talked about, right. The climate inside the cabin? That's a much stronger narrative to have as a user it within your social service
right.
than necessarily having a logo on your jacket or being affiliated with a certain brand. So this has become times where hot air and fluffy stories and beautiful models and TV commercials have much, I don't say it's not important or it doesn't have a place in an ecosystem for a company, but it's just not what's driving brand relationships and brand love. That comes from product features.
Yeah, and certain features, again, how do you translate product features into revenue?
Mm.
In the traditional mindset, that's adding a feature for a price and upgrading the price point based on the cost that it took to develop that technology. Mm. So you make a basic calculation of price, volume, take rate, and you cost and price for a feature based on how many additional units you can sell based on that feature. That's the traditional way the automotive industry product planner would go about justifying adding a trim level or adding a package, a new package or a new feature to a vehicle. I don't think that works that way in the user-centric world.
Mm.
The user-centric world is about the average revenue per user. What new users were you able to add to the total addressable market that you're selling into? And what additional revenue per user are you able to generate because that feature unlocks a new revenue stream?
Mm.
Right? The unlocking of downstream revenue is outside the scope of traditional product-based industries. There are manufacturers. Their business relationship generally ends after the factory of that makes the car or the replacement part. So the business model of a traditional industry company is how many units did I sell and how many replacement parts or how much F&I, financing, insurance, that generates revenue for me after the factory. The user-centric mindset says, how much revenue do I generate with products that have this feature, which means I have to sell it at a reasonable enough price so that I get a large number of people to have it. The more people that have it, the more transactional revenue I can generate from the recurring use of that product. That's a utility-based mindset. The word utility is usage. Utilities is about how much you use it. And how much it's being used is based on the number of units that are out there. The lower the price or the more affordable the product is to purchase means more people will have it. If more people have it and it has technology features that they can brag about. Number one, you bought it because it's got this feature. But number two, it made my life better because it provided me with this utility that I wouldn't have.
Fulfills the need, right?
You fulfill the need.
It's really that simple. All business should be about understanding a need, develop a way to fulfill it. And by fulfilling a need, you become relevant. But a lot of MNCs don't do that when they produce for China or import to China. They have a product already. And they wish to make it relevant through marketing or, you know, price or whatever have you. Yeah. This is a never-ending battle. This you never win that fight because as soon as you take your foot off the pedal line, cut your advertising budget, you are returned to where you came from.
Right.
Because you are fundamentally not relevant because you don't necessarily fulfill a need.
Right. You don't compete on a feature price value equation in the same world. The only way you can win is that world doesn't coexist with yours.
Right.
And that's what you're finding. The reason why Chinese brands have gone from 34% share of the market to 69% share, they've acquired about a third of the market in the span of just 5 years. How did that happen? Well, because they created digital relevancy in an era where that matters, in a market where that matters. It may matter less, and that might be the only hope left for the multinationals. First of all, it's not 100%. They won't own the whole world because even though the lane is shrinking of relevancy for product-based businesses, there's still a lane. It's going to be smaller. It's a third or maybe even less, a quarter of the market by 2030.
Yeah.
There will be still people that will buy the Rolex, but there are fewer of them than would buy the Apple Watch.
Yeah.
So when the car becomes a smart device, they're going to be the vast majority of people are going to want that. Especially if you can make it affordable. But there's still going to be people that want the Lamborghini, the Rolls, they're going to still want to wear the jewelry of the very high-end ultra-luxury product, but there are probably not going to be as many of them in the future than there were in the past.
That's another conversation. We can do that another day, but the whole disruption of luxury is because of that, in my opinion.
Right.
This luxury will not go back where it came from.
No.
Because our preferences for what type of products we buy and what kind of products we need to build status and respect in our social circle, it has just changed.
You need a minimally acceptable level of digital relevance.
Mm.
And if you eschew that completely and say it's irrelevant, my brand doesn't represent that, then you're dropped from the purchase consideration list. Mm. It doesn't mean you have to make it the brand image. Your brand image is your brand image, what you want your brand to represent. If your Rolls Royce, your ultra luxury, consumers are going to want bragging rights that are more ornamentation, more hand craftsmanship. It's going to be more of that. If you're Ferrari, it's a racing car, but to have zero digital relevancy and give you nothing but analog and zero digital, you're not even, you're relegated to a smaller market, not a zero, but a smaller one than what you had before.
And this is really an evolution of the Chinese market, because we've been here almost the same amount of years. And I remember when I came to China, the highest sought after item was a Louis Vuitton bag. That's the simplest form of building social status through affiliating yourself with a brand. There's no function or unique functionality, nothing else. There's a brand, and basically that brand says that you're sophisticated and maybe first and foremost you can afford it, right? So that was what people were looking for 25 years ago. Today, people look for something which is much more personally fulfilling. We want better lives. We want better balance in our lives. We want to be healthy. We want to have fun. We want a lot of different things. This shift is not only happening in China, but in China, all this is on steroids.
Right.
The MNCs, they're still living with a perception of being the brand is good enough. Mm. The functionality is less important. And this has changed in China. And maybe it's harder for a multinational company being far away from your home and your innovation base to actually keep up with this and understand that change.
This is a big challenge for foreign businesses in China. Is number one, do you have your ear to the ground as to what's changing in the way the consumers think about their relationship with brands? In China, things do change quickly. It's always been true. You talked about earlier, the excuses that typically are made. First is, can you overcome your arrogance and accept the fact that consumers in particular in places that do change rapidly, generation to generation, they may make a different choice, that you can't impose your value system on a place that has inherently its own way of thinking about the market and has now competitive Chinese brands that can solve problems for them that didn't exist 20 years ago, 25 years ago. That's what's changed, is you've got competitors who understand the psychology of the market better, who grew up in a digitally connected era and understand the Chinese consumer needs better than you do.
And as an MNC, you're not going to change China. If it happens, China will change you.
You can impose your will on China when there's no competition, which is what the first 35 years of the automotive industry history of the 40 since the formation of this first Sino-Foreign JVs, you had your way for 35 years, but they caught up. Unfortunately, they caught up coincidentally, by the way, at a time where you stopped traveling to China, your headquarters people weren't coming here. That's a coincidence.
Right.
That is not the reason. Mm. And that's the other thing that I heard explained a lot is, oh, COVID happened and then China changed. No, China was changing all along.
Yes.
It didn't bother you at the time. You were still profiting from it, but now it changed and you weren't able to see it.
Yeah.
Whose problem is that? The foreign companies blamed things that were not the reason why they ran into the problems that they have now, as a convenient way of excusing themselves from the responsibility.
I around Chinese New Year, I read a list about foreign businesses primarily in food and beverage closing the last year. And this list, I just read here from my screen, the list including City Shop, that used to be Shanghai's leading supermarket for importing foreign goods. It was Sherpas that used to be a food home delivery service. Carrefour, the French supermarket chain, has a few shops left. But if you go there, it looks like they are on their swan song. It's half empty and poor products. According to customer reviews or user reviews on Genping, at least, Japanese fast food giant Mos Burger completely pulled out of China. And Simply Thai, who have been here since 1999 and ironically enough was my first employer in China. I didn't work in the restaurant. I worked in there in that back office. But nonetheless, all these companies closed. And the conclusion in the magazine were, oh, this is so sad that these foreign businesses close because of COVID and lack of people going out after COVID. But when I read this list, the list was much longer than what these are just the highlights of the list. I didn't get a feeling this is because of COVID. I got a feeling that this is a list of companies that haven't followed with the change of China.
Yep.
Because all these companies has not followed the shift in user sentiment. They keep doing. I can talk about Simply Thai. I used to work there. It didn't change since 1999. And the same with Carrefour and others. And I don't try to ditch on any brand or company. There can be reasons why it is like that.
Yeah.
But it's just important, in my humble opinion, to realize that you don't die because of COVID. You don't die because people don't travel for a few years. This can enhance or speed up the process.
Yeah.
But there are other underlying reasons why you suffer.
Yeah, and COVID was just an event that forced a pivot in one way or another to whatever you were doing before, you've got to do something different now. Every business had to contend with that because the way people went about their lives changed, right?
Mm.
So these industry after industry, all were affected. Either it was their upstream supply chain, their downstream customers were changing their habits, and the relevancy of digital went exponential at that time, right? Our dependency on app-based services to be able to get access to the things we needed, including mobility, or the things that were served to us through a mobility-related platform. The internet's entry, the internet economy's entry into the problem-solving around everyday use services has changed in a fundamental way the value delivery system that includes now the type of product that serves mobility.
Yeah.
Right? The entry of Alibaba and Tencent into the automotive industry, they actually make cars today branded as NIO and XPeng with the Alibaba and Tencent ecosystem. They were invested by those companies. The whole idea of the user-centric business model, I've heard William Lee talk about that for more than a decade, right? His embodiment of the user-centric mindset. He doesn't even call his customers customers. He calls them users. That's internet speak. When presented with discontinuous change, with a disruptive change, traditional manufacturers who see that, and by that I do mean Geely, by that, I do mean the state-owned companies as well, Cherry. I also mean companies like BYD, who we regard as a big disruptor in the automotive industry today. They were a traditional company. They were making gasoline-powered vehicles before they made an electric
vehicle. I mean, even started by, dare I say, copy Western businesses.
Absolutely.
Certainly.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But what they do, that the Western automakers, and by Western, I mean mature and traditional, and I include the Japanese and the Koreans in that category, is they don't reject the evidence that's in front of their eyes. Even traditional Chinese companies pivot faster. When they see a disruptor arrive, they embrace or they try to emulate. And that's the fascinating thing that I see going on, is you got different experiments. This is a country and a system that breathes innovation because of experimentation.
Mm.
Trial and error in many cases, many of which will fail.
Mm.
It's not a perfect system. It will overly fragment, and it will do things that seem crazy, and many of them will fail.
Mm.
NIO will build a battery swapping infrastructure, will build NIO houses. They'll try to go direct to the consumer, and they'll try to do that everywhere in the world at the same time. Seems like a CapEx designed to fail because too expensive to try to build a business model like that. But here they are. They're trying to do it. Then you got companies like Xiaomi and Huawei and BYD, all of whom are experimental in their own way, all with the intention of solving the problem that is embraced by a very progressive Chinese consumer who is much more willing to accept the changes.
I heard that the CEO of Volkswagen was here in China and said up in Beijing, we are in China now because we are 6 years behind the local competition. We have to stay here just to keep up.
That's the best argument I can offer. Is that if you're not in China, you're not witness to the future being created right in front of you. You're too far away. You're basically putting yourself in a bubble and hoping it doesn't come to your world.
Yeah.
Right. Which is kind of what happened with COVID. We were isolated from China. We weren't seeing it every day. Or if we were hearing about it from the people that we had deployed in China, we weren't listening to them. And because of that, we kind of blamed them for not, you know, a lot of companies have gone through this era now where they're replacing their Chinese leadership with, or their local team with somebody from headquarters. I don't know how that person's going to do it any better than the people that were here that you weren't listening to. But what the heck? If you're looking for a convenient excuse, you don't want it to be your headquarters, then blame the people who are in China. The problem is systemic. The problem is you're just not in tune with the rapidly changing environment that exists here.
So does the MNC have a chance here? Is it game over?
No, I don't think it's game over. I think it's actually good to hear leaders like Oliver Bloom and others step up and say, "Hey, I've got to make change, and I know I need to embrace the change, and I need to be here for that reason. If I retreat, I'm not going to be able to see it firsthand. I'm not going to be able to compete with it. I got to be in that game." Not enough are doing that. I would say Tesla has been here. They have the largest production footprint in the world here. They have other issues now with their brand image now with the geopolitical pivot for Elon Musk. But they're not withdrawing from China. It's more than half of the volume for this company that's built in China. Volkswagen, maybe get it wrong a few times and eventually you figure it out. But you've got a reason to be here. And you got to stay motivated and you got to build local partnerships, right? You can't try to go 100% on your own in China. You need to have a local ecosystem that you're engaged with. And they are doing partnerships with XPeng and Horizon and, you know, a few other players to build digital relevancy. I think the mistake they made early on is they tried to do everything on the software domain themselves with an initiative called CARIAD that they hired a bunch of German engineers to be the digital disruptors in software. Well, guess what? They don't have the schooling for that. You need Chinese inspiration. You need a user-centric mindset in the market that is defining the pathway towards that to be the tip of your spear in opening that up. And maybe then you can bring that to the rest of the world in your brand, right? You may take a smaller lane of relevancy in China, but because you're still here, you're able to gain a wider birth in the global automotive landscape. And there's an opportunity now with Tesla struggling for some of the foreign companies outside to maybe win back some of that, claw back some of that market that they lost to Tesla over the past few years. And I would offer the other argument, which is this is the biggest superscaler for technology. It's not only embracing innovation faster than the rest of the world, the EV and the smart cabin-oriented way of thinking about the business. I think it's going to probably do that for the autonomous driving as well. If you want access to the aggregate learning that comes from that, then you need to keep your foot in the pool of the China market. You have to have the inspiration and the motivation to keep up with the companies that are setting the pace for those changes here.
I would like to say we're almost done, but I would like to say in my 25 years, I've seen these waves of reason to do business with China. In the beginning, you sourced products here, then you start next wave was setting up your own production. And a little bit later, after a couple of other waves, you started to sell your products in China.
Right.
But now I see a new reason to caring or being interesting in China from a commercial point of view, and that is learning from China. And all this has happened in 30 years.
Yeah.
It's quite mind-blowing.
We've got to reverse the flow of innovation. that and relax the degrees, create more degrees of freedom of how we think about the future. You cannot constrain innovation based on your legacy. Mm-hmm. I think that would be the biggest inspiration you can get from China is this is a market that approaches the future in an unconstrained way of thinking about it.
Mm-hmm.
And has, because of its acceleration of growth occurring simultaneously with the mobile internet, and because that's been so transformative to the way people live their lives, and because people have embraced it because it made their lives easier and more convenient, they're expecting every product to have smart features that make things more convenient.
That's a hygiene factor.
And if you don't have it, you're not in the game anymore. We need to take inspiration from that, because we need some of that to splash back onto the automotive industry globally, or we're not going to have a global automotive industry.
That's a wrap for this episode of China Biz. Want to go deeper? Check out my in-depth article packed with insights and data, link in the description. And who should be next on the show? Got ideas or feedback? Let's connect on LinkedIn or WeChat. Details below. And don't forget, subscribe and share China Biz with your network. Thanks for listening.